Welcome to Boss Files. I'm Poppy Harlow. You may be a founder with a visionary idea, an employee at a young startup, or at a big company. But when you think of your company's culture, what goes through your head? Is it ping pong tables and beanbag chairs and free employee lunch? Those are all great, of course, but my guest today says they're not culture. So what is company culture truly, and how do you create it? Ben Horowitz is the co-founder of the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz. Think early investors in Facebook, Lyft, and many more companies. His first book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things, is a Silicon Valley Bible for entrepreneurs. Now, he's taking that one step further in a new book out this month called What You Do Is Who You Are.
The CEO really has to be the chief ethics officer. But look, companies don't have bad ethics because they intend to have bad ethics generally. Like, that's very, very, very rare. It's a systems problem. It's not a, I don't know what the difference between right and wrong, or even like, you know, I don't believe we want to do the right thing. It's a lack of implementation.
He sits on the board of Lyft, now a public company that is reassessing its own culture in the ride-sharing race with Uber. And he weighs in on the role Facebook plays today.
I think like the Facebook community is very powerful, but it is a giant community. But like the history of media or media technology has been that it has had a lot of political power. For example, the radio got Hitler elected. No question, right? Like without the radio, his rise to power doesn't happen. The television got Kennedy elected. Facebook got Obama elected.
Did Facebook get Everybody President was Trump happy. Elected?
I think President Trump won on Facebook, no question. And that's what actually triggered the outrage. But it's something that's been going on for years.
So let's jump right into my conversation with Ben Horowitz.
Ben Horowitz, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
It's nice to meet you. I've read so much about you for years, so thank you for coming in.
Oh, well, no, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Congratulations on the book, What You Do Is Who You Are. Mm-hmm. Make the case.
Well, so it's about culture, and the title actually comes from the Way of the Warrior, the code of the samurai. And basically what the samurai say is a culture is not a set of beliefs, it's a set of actions. And culture, it really is about the behaviors kind of in your company that happen every day. So like, why does somebody return a phone call like in 5 minutes versus
a
like
week?
3 days or a week or never?
Right.
And just ghost you. And you know, why do people go home at 5 versus go home at 8 p.m.? Why, when somebody does a business deal, do they care about the price versus a partnership? Like, all that is your culture. And none of it is in your mission statement or your OKRs or your KPIs, right? Like, it's kind of this very amorphous thing. And it's, you know, you can put values on the wall, but like, that doesn't mean people are going to follow them.
It's just paint.
Yeah, it's just paint. And you get a hypocritical culture, right? Because it's like, oh, that's what we believe in, but that's not what we do. And, you know, people say, oh, well, but then you can like put in somebody's performance review. Well, how do you know if they return the phone call? You know, like, so it's a very, very kind of complex, systematic thing to set a culture, but it's very important because that's how people who work at your business experience your business, mm-hmm. and that's how people who interact with your company, like, know your company. They know it by your culture.
What I find interesting about you telling us all of this is that you lived it. Like, you went through it and screwed up. So you learn this firsthand.
Yeah, no, sadly, yes. And and that's when I realized not only how complicated it was, but nobody had really articulated what it is, how you move it, how you change it, and the way it actually works. You know, it's not something that you like set up in the beginning of the company and then that's it. You know, you do have to evolve it, you have to fix it, you have to change it. And it has to align with what you want out of the business as well.
So before we move on to much more serious, much more important stuff than this, I just have to stop and say, rumor has it that you have a reputation for being able to recite almost any rap lyric. Is this true?
Well, it's not any rap lyric.
Can
rap
I test
is a very
you?
Vast
yes, it is.
Like field.
Can I test you? Because I think you're old enough for this one, because it used to be my favorite song.
Oh, well, yeah.
Warren G. Regulators.
yeah.
Can I get one line?
I can't even remember the song, but it's Warren G doing the sing-song voice. You need to regulate.
It was a clear black night, something like that. Yeah. All right, so this is true about you.
Dr. Dre's cousin.
But in all honesty, one of the quotes that has struck you the most and I think changed your life, it sounds like, is something Nas said. Right?
Yeah, well, a lot of things Nas said. But, the thing that I really kind of appreciated later in life is he said, you think my life is good because my diamond piece, but my life's been good since I've been finding peace. And that's so not one, I like it because it's so Nas. It's just kind of, he's a philosopher rapper. But it really is kind of, I feel like that's my theme song for late in life.
So you found peace.
I feel like I did. maybe when I stopped being CEO. I was always
really?
At war.
When and how did you find peace? Because money is not, you've got plenty of that. Money is not peace.
No, and as you can see, you have a lot of people with money committing crimes and doing all kinds of stuff to keep money and get more money and that kind of thing. I think it's much more around, who you are in life. Do you kind of figure out, who do you want to be and how do you share that and how do you make your contribution from, what you can do?
Your business partner, Mark Andreessen, says the 21st century is the century of disagreeableness. You smile. Yeah. Do you agree?
Well, he's big into this, the Big Five personality test and how your personality traits kind of determine a lot of things. And disagreeableness is a personality trait. And it is very highly correlated with entrepreneurship because a key thing in an entrepreneur is they have to be able to think for themselves and think in new ways and breakthrough ways. And any kind of innovative idea is always an idea that most people will hate because if it wasn't, then they would have all thought of it and done it. And so I think it's his way of saying it's the age of the entrepreneur.
Okay, so the age of the entrepreneur.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the entrepreneur CEO or the founder CEO or just CEOs in general that you're writing this book partly to, at least.
Yes.
You make the argument that not nearly enough CEOs and leaders actually make hard choices and make enough hard choices and are willing enough to be disliked. They want to be liked. I want to be liked.
Yes.
I don't want to be disliked. Yeah. But that's a problem?
Yeah, it's definitely a problem. And a lot of it is, do you want to be liked in the short term? Or
all of the above.
Or in the long term. And they end up being different. Here's the problem is, if you make a decision that is actually, if you make a decision that everybody in the company likes, then they would have made that decision even if you weren't there. So you haven't actually done anything or added any value or done anything important. So your most important decisions end up being ones that, many people don't like, or at least, some people don't like. And if you need everybody to be happy with every decision, you're never going to be a good leader. And I think we experience some of this in the world. That's a challenge. And people want to make their whole constituency happy or whatever.
So take Machiavelli.
Yes.
Better to be feared than loved?
Well, I think that in the short term, it's better to make the correct decision than to be loved, is the way I would put it. Much better.
But what inspires more? What have you found in all of the companies that you guys have invested in and put your faith and your money behind?
Yeah, I don't think you can run a new technology company by fear because the employees are at will. most people, the great employees aren't going to be getting terrorized by the CEO. And even firing somebody isn't that big a threat in technology business because there's more jobs than people.
You write about how it is even more complicated to really nail the culture issue and get it right in big companies.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, scale makes it difficult, right? Because you have more points of view. But lead by example doesn't work at all in a big company. A little, right? If you lead, you can set a bad example and people will follow that. But you set a good example, you're not going to get 100% cultural coherence off of that. You need much, much more than that the bigger you get. If you're a team of five, that'll probably work.
So let's talk about prison. This is unexpected for anyone who hasn't read your book. It certainly, for me, sort of came out of nowhere. But a prison and criminal justice reform, et cetera, in this country informs a lot of this. So it seems like a surprising source of inspiration, shall I say, for some of what you write. And you found that prison gangs thrive on culture. Quote, if you come into prison and you don't do things the right way, you die. What did you learn from looking at prison culture?
Well, an awful lot. So first of all, you go like, well, why are prisons so violent? And I think people assume, oh, it's because, you know, the people coming in are really violent. But it's really the culture is like super violent. It wasn't designed that way, but it got that way. And I tell a story in the book where Shaka Singor, he enters prison his first day in prison. He goes into the kind of recreational area and a prisoner walks up to another prisoner and stabs him in the neck. And the prisoner dies, and the other guy throws the shank in the trash, goes to the cafeteria and has a sandwich. And Shaka said, well, when I saw that, I had to ask myself, could I do that? And I said, wait a minute, Shaka, you're in prison for murder. You already did that.
Right.
And he said, no, I didn't do that. What I did is I'm in a drug deal. The guy jumps out of the car and starts rushing me. I had a gun in my pocket. I had a reaction and I shot him. That's what I did. What this guy did is he spent 2 weeks taking a 2-liter bottle, filing it into a weapon, then decided, am I going to stab him in the stomach or in the neck? Am I going to wound him or am I going to kill him? And then he kills the guy and then keeps it moving to the chow hall and has a sandwich. I couldn't do that. But I had to ask myself, could I do that? Because that's what was required to survive here. And so you can see the culture, even somebody who came in with like a record of a violent crime became way more violent
because
he had to do it to survive in that culture. And when people enter a company, you know, people think, oh, we've got these values, integrity. But okay, then like first day, you know, new employee comes to work. What is the new employee? They're looking around saying, okay, who's really successful here? Or what are they doing? Oh, that really successful person just took credit for that other person's work. That's what you have to do to succeed here. And that's what builds your culture. And that's what creates it, not what you say. It's what you
what
do.
What you actually
exactly.
do. So for people who don't know about Shaka Singor, I had him on 3 years ago. We did a big profile piece on him. He spent 19 years in prison, 7 in solitary confinement for what you just described. And he wrote this book, Righting My Wrongs, Life, Death, and Redemption in America. Right. You argue prison is a fertile ground for understanding culture because people who end up in prison generally come from broken cultures.
Yes.
If in advising leaders of companies of all sizes, what lesson should they really take to heart from those experiences? Because I guarantee you almost none of them have spent any time in prisons, or most of them, I'd assume, not learning about them in the way that you did.
Well, I think that like one of the big ones for me is that culture often determines who you are. So Shaka came up in prison culture, as you know. And, you know, like there's a question, okay, is he the guy who like led the Melanix, the very violent gang, and like killed a guy and so forth? Is that who he is? Or is he like this guy who's a best-selling author, like an amazing speaker, a guy who, you know, is executive director of the Anti-Recidivism Coalition and helps people get like, or is he that guy? Like, who is he really? And the answer is really both, because what you do is who you are. He was that guy and he changed his culture. And he, by the way, changed the culture of the Melanix while he was there and then, you know, became a completely different person. And I think that you have to keep that in mind in that, like, you can change your employees. Like, I've seen companies change their employees into bad people where, like, people end up...
Can you give me an example?
You know, well, look, you scream at people at work. Guess what they're going to do at home?
Scream at people at home.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not to interrupt, but you just made an argument that I want to hone in on a little bit because you just said people can change.
Yes.
You fundamentally
companies can change.
Believe people and companies can really change to the core.
Oh, yeah. I'm Will Shaka Singor.
Sure. Recidivism in the United States, I don't have to tell you how big of a problem it is. It's like 70%. 3 out of 4 individuals go back to prison. But something's happening in
China. And interestingly, it's not that way in all countries.
Oh, no.
We have
it's horrible here.
A specifically very bad criminal justice system.
Absolutely. But what I'm seeing now changing as just someone who studies this a bit from the outside, not the way you have, but I have keen interest in it. Some companies are doing something about that. JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon just told me a few months ago when we sat down, they are actively hiring more ex-felons. And if a bank can do that and they're trying to change the rules to be allowed to do that, that tells me something is changing. Do you believe more companies should be willing to hire ex-felons to really change the narrative here, change the game?
Oh, absolutely. And I think there, look, you can't put an embezzler in charge of the money, right? Like there are
but
certain things,
there are
things,
other
right?
jobs they can do.
Yeah, and you can't like take a child molester and have them watch kids. Like, so I think that's the thing people have in mind. However, like most people in prison got there. Actually, they're not even the main like person in the crime. They're like friends with the person in the crime. They're in the car or they're doing this. But like when you look at the prison population, so many people were, I would call like more the beta personality, not even the leader. And if you put them in a situation with a different culture and a different way of doing things, they've served their sentence. They paid their debt to society. They're very, very motivated. And, you know, the companies that we have that hire ex-convicts, and I always forget the language, but sorry, people coming out of prison. But, you know, people have been in jail, is they tend to be, like, way more loyal from a kind of attrition standpoint. So
for being given another shot.
Oh, they're so grateful for just having a chance at life again.
The Haitian Revolution. Something
yes.
I knew not a lot about. I think most people reading your book, not a lot about.
Yeah.
But you make an argument in here about the Haitian Revolution, slave culture. How does that apply to corporate America today?
Yeah, so it's probably the greatest cultural change story that I know of, and maybe in history. So there's only been one successful slave revolt in the history of humanity. And you know, like slavery goes back a while. You know, like the Bible, like endorses it, and so it's like it's a very old institution, and the reason that there's never been a successful slave revolt other than this one is slave culture is like just terrible in the military context because in the dehumanization process, right? You don't control your tomorrow, right? Like, I don't own me, I don't own what I'm going to do tomorrow, so I'm not going to plan for it. And if there's no kind of tomorrow, then there's no trust, because trust is a long-term concept. I do this for you today because down the line, you're going to do something for me,
sure.
kind of thing. Military culture, on the other hand, if you don't trust the order, like, you have chaos. And so how do you get from a group of slaves to a military fighting force that not only defeats Napoleon, but Napoleon suffers more casualties in Haiti than in Waterloo? Like,
right.
How did that come about? How did he transform the culture? And when you get into its leader, Toussaint Louverture, who was born a slave, but mastered French colonial culture, mastered military culture as described by Julius Caesar in Caesar's Commentaries, and constructed a new kind of modern and interesting and powerful hybrid culture that was made an amazing military force. And the techniques that he used to do it, and there were many, which I go through, like the seven main ones in the book and all that kind of thing, is just incredibly instructive to how you would kind of change a culture in a company,
well,
how you would direct
yourself,
a culture.
Right?
Yes. And also like the power of culture and ethics. And I'll give you kind of one like quick or semi-quick example of the power of ethics that he did. So he outlawed pillaging in his army.
Yeah, this is a powerful one.
Yeah. And so pillaging, right, in that time, like that was like the incentive for the soldiers. So it's a very kind of fundamental thing that they get to do. I get to get stuff if I fight for you. Mm. And he said, look, we're fighting for liberty. So you can't fight for liberty and take people's liberty away. That's not going to work. And like the legend on the battlefield of it was amazing, because you had like French soldiers and Spanish soldiers pillaging through the town. And then you have this half-naked slave army going through and not taking anything. And it was so strong that the white women in the colony, I mean, this is like an ex-slave in a slave revolt, the white women in the colony supported him and called him father. And so you just go, wow, like that, his culture was so powerful, he got local support where he never should have got local support. And, you know, those techniques, those ideas of, you know, what you get, like what's the value of having a strong culture is very, very
interesting. What you are is what you do, right?
Yes.
For him.
Yes.
More from my conversation with Ben Horowitz after the break.
I'd like to spend a little time talking about ethics, if we could.
Yes.
Given the importance of ethics and given the conversation, shall I say, around it in Silicon Valley right now. So Kara Swisher, great tech journalist, as you know, has said many times, she's written about it, she told me in our interview, that especially tech companies, need chief ethics officers. Is she right?
So I don't think that's quite right. Here's the problem that people have, because it's got to come from the CEO. Like, if you have somebody on the side.
So the CEO needs to be the chief ethics officer.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's like if the head of HR is the person who determines your culture, nobody's going to follow it because they don't report to the head of HR. They don't report, like the reporting relationship in a company is very powerful. So the CEO really has to be the chief ethics officer. But look, companies don't have bad ethics because they intend to have bad ethics generally. Like, that's very, very, very rare. It's a systems problem. It's not a, I don't know what the difference between right and wrong, or even like, you know, I don't believe we want to do the right thing. It's a lack of implementation. And so I'll give you an example. So Uber, which had a very, I would say, well-developed, well-architected culture, with really like exciting values, always be hustling, you know, super pumped, all that kind of thing. And they trained on it, and they were really good at it. And as a result, they were like, you know, from a cultural standpoint, probably the most competitive, like that competitiveness, competitive company in Silicon Valley. But they never, it wasn't that they didn't have an intent on ethics or anything, but there was never like an explicit kind of statement of it, and there was no programming of it into the culture. Right. So when it came down to competitiveness versus, you know, should you be like hyper-competitive or should you not cross an ethical line? Like, you're silent on this one, and like everything in your training is on this one, the competitiveness would kind of overrun whatever Travis would have liked to have ethically, you know, implemented. So it was one of these things where, and many companies never say what their ethics are. And even the replacement statement, just do the right thing, period. Well, what is
the
right
thing?
Yeah, like what is the right thing? And for different people, it's different things. And in business, it's often very, very fuzzy what the right thing is.
So you guys could have chosen to put your money in and your backing into Uber, and you didn't, and you put it into Lyft instead. Was that because of ethics and culture?
I think that would be giving us a little too much credit in that.
Well, you said, yeah. Let me quote you, 2013 to CNBC, yeah. We like the character and culture of the Lyft guys better than Uber.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that was true. And look, we had a interaction on the fundraising where it gave us pause on Uber. But I don't think we really understood the whole company's culture in depth.
What gave you
know,
pause?
It's very hard to do that.
Can you tell me what
happened? Well, you know, like there's certain things where like a deal gets retraded in ways that make you think, okay, if he's willing to tell us that and do that, then like how far does that go,
Travis,
in other contexts? Yes.
What did he tell you guys?
You know, and I can't even, like, it was a long time ago, so I don't want to, like, put words in his mouth and revisit the, or redo the conversation, but it was just like, okay, this is the deal, no, that's the deal, kind of thing.
Do you believe that the culture and ethics have taken a front seat at Uber now under Dara?
Well, I think he has been much more serious about saying, okay, there's certain things we're not going to do.
Yeah.
I think, though, that the other interesting thing about it is he got rid of the rest of the Uber culture, which much of it was very powerful and strong and made the company highly successful under Travis. So, you know, it will be interesting to watch to see how that plays out.
I should note, obviously, you have a dog in this fight, a big dog.
Oh, yeah, big
called
dog.
Lyft.
Yeah, yeah, no,
you're on the
qualify that out. Yeah, right.
You're
I
on
mean,
the
yes,
board
absolutely.
Of Lyft. So let's talk about that right now, because I've interviewed John and Logan, and they've had a lot of success. They're also facing issues right now. They've got this lawsuit from 14 women accusing the company of mishandling sexual assault and rape cases. Mm-hmm. How is their culture, at this point, given that lawsuit? And I should note that John Zimmer said, we have zero tolerance for this type of behavior. Mm-hmm. There's always more to do. It's our number one responsibility. Given this lawsuit and these accusations from these women, is their Lyft culture now different than Uber's?
Well, I think that like this gets into the scale issue, right? This isn't, so these are networks of drivers. So the drivers are currently independent contractors who sign up and drive the cars. And Lyft has a set of safety measures and so forth that they take on to protect the safety of their passengers. The drivers are not, I would say because there's so many of them, aren't in the Lyft culture in the same way that the employees are. That's not saying that they shouldn't be, or that there shouldn't be more done to make sure that, like, you know, just from a, like a policing standpoint, as well as like, I think it's, you know, at that scale, it's more than just a cultural thing. It's a policing thing as well. Like, how do you handle that? So, you know, it's a complicated problem. Yeah. I think it's different than the kind of original issues that they had at Uber, but like they're definitely issues nonetheless.
I hear you on sort of the difference here, but I would just push back a little bit and ask you, as someone who advises them, you're a board member, this is a pivotal moment, I think, for the company reputationally and sort of, you know, where it goes. There was a CNET piece earlier this month, the headline, Lyft is fostering a sexual assault epidemic, victims say. How are you advising them, or would you, on the culture front? Meaning, even though there are all these drivers that aren't in the office, when you build a business that's their model, do they need to be doing more? Because some of these women are saying that Lyft is stonewalling law enforcement, they're negligent on background checks. I guess, is this an important conversation, a moment of reckoning for them?
Well, I feel like I think that because it's a litigation, like I can't get into like the actual conversation that I'm having. But yeah, look, it's a safety issues are the most important thing for sure for the company from a business strategy standpoint. Yeah. And I think they're very focused on it, as I said.
Okay, understand. We'll look forward to seeing what happens next. Is there a lesson from WeWork and what has happened and Adam Neumann? And the failed IPO. Well, you've got to be thinking about that a lot,
look,
right?
There's many lessons. I think one thing on it is, look, he had a very kind of, you know, like Uber, like a really great culture in many ways, in that they got people to believe in such a big vision. I mean, you know, the optimism of WeWork and, like, we're going to change the nature of work and it's going to be way better and the quality of employees they were able to attract, and the amount, the gigantic amount of money they were able to raise. So it had a lot of that. I think that what often happens in a culture, though, is whatever your strength is, if you're not very careful, it can be the weakness. And obviously, things got loose from just the way the business was run. Mm-hmm. And there's no way that, like, many employees didn't know it was getting loose. And I'm sure that
there's no way they didn't know. Like, felt it.
Oh, they definitely knew. And I think they for sure said something. But I think that when you have that level of optimism, sometimes the company cannot hear culturally bad news. And it seems like, I don't know because I'm not that close to WeWork, right, but it seems like that's what's happened. So that's kind of on the one side. Then there's the other thing that people always ask about, which is, well, why did SoftBank pay Adam so much
money?
Well,
that was my follow-up question, yeah. Ben. I mean, give me your opinion on SoftBank.
So that wasn't not a cultural thing. That was a leverage
pumping billions
thing
into WeWork, now coming to the rescue. He gets to walk away with a ton of money.
Yeah, so the reason he was, so there's an old saying, which is if you owe the bank $1 million, the bank owns you. But if you owe the bank $1 billion, you own the bank. And I think in this case, he not only owned SoftBank, but he owned J.P. Morgan Chase, and that combination enabled him to make a lot of money personally, which, whatever you think about it, that was a leverage situation more than a culture situation. And look, I think that, you know, SoftBank certainly contributed to the ambition of WeWork and that they gave them a giant amount of money and they said, like, I want you to make it much bigger than, you know, the original idea. And that's when they got all the rest of the Wii's.
including licensing Wii however that played out.
Yeah. Well, that was a governance issue for sure.
When Marc Benioff of Salesforce was asked about this a few weeks ago at TechCrunch, mm-hmm. and he said something that really struck me, and I wonder if you agree. He said that a lot of companies are staying private way too long, so they're not facing sort of the reckoning of the public market soon enough. Does he have a point?
Well, so I do think that on governance, there is a big line between private and public, and I would say the reason for that is that there's the laws aren't that different between private and public. I mean, there's the 34 Act reporting rules and so forth, but the laws aren't that different. But the enforcement on private companies is relatively non-existent for things like misrepresenting numbers, related party transactions, et cetera. Like, it's, you know, it is loose. Now, it's being an ex-public company CEO, like, not if you're dealing with me, like, I am very hard with these guys on governance, but it is a real thing, and you know, that is, but that's part of SoftBank's proposition. You don't have to go public. We'll give you the money without going public.
Sure.
And so there's, I think there's definitely some truth to it. Like, I went completely, I went discounted. It's subtle, but it's, there's a real truth to it.
Stay tuned. Ben Horowitz weighs in on diversity in Silicon Valley.
Facial recognition.
Mm-hmm.
I find this, not only the technology, fascinating and hugely important and consequential, but also I'm fascinated by the divide in big tech right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So on facial recognition, you've got the likes of Amazon and Andy Jassian,
yeah,
who are saying we're going full steam ahead. We are not apologizing for working with the government on this. Like,
yeah,
this is important.
Yeah.
And then you have some others like Google who are pausing on the API and at least viewing it a little bit differently. And I wonder what your view is. Where do you fall on this? Because it can be very helpful to society, and some of the built-in biases that have not been fixed yet can be very harmful to society.
Well, I do think it's a little bit inevitable. So, like, the truth is, they can not just ID you on facial, they can ID you on gait analysis, like the way you walk. Like, you know, in China, they picked a guy in a stadium, a concert, out by his walk. So I think, you know, a little bit.
Which has a whole host of implications and issues in China, too.
Yeah, yeah, and I think we're running behind the curve. I mean, I do think that in general, I'm pro, particularly where we are now. I think we're in a situation where you have a free society with freedom of speech, actual, some, you know, real privacy protection.
The U.S. you're talking
about.
Yeah,
the U.S., yeah. And and, you know, and another society who we're in a technological race with, China, that does definitely not have that. And we're getting a real, like, strong dose of that. I mean, Daryl Morey, like, does a retweet, not a tweet, a retweet,
right,
and then deletes it. And, like, they're so information control oriented, they're, like, ready to kick the NBA out of China. So, like, that's a pretty, like, scary thing. And so my general belief is, us supplying technology to the U.S. government is generally a very good idea, and we should do it, and we should support the men and women who support us and protect us with the best technology possible. And I think that, you know, I disagree with what Google is doing. I agree with what Amazon's doing on it, you know,
what about in
a broad
China?
Sense.
What should the NBA's experience in China teach us, and how does it inform you? You guys have companies that operate in China, Lime, others, and I just wonder, you know, you look at the Hong Kong protests, like, CEOs, I think, internally are freaking out, and they don't know how to answer these questions, many of them, and they are trying to decide what they're going to do.
Yes. So this is a very complex situation, because you have a lot of businesses, and you have a lot of clear hypocrisy going on now, where you've got, you know, Tim Cook running around saying how much he cares about individual rights, and then this goes to China and censors everything. So, like, as long as you're not Chinese, Tim Cook supports you, that kind of thing. So, you know, but you can see how he got into that situation. Like, China was kind of fundamental to how they built their business, and they're a global company, and, you know, you can't just pull out that easily. In fact, it would be devastating for Apple to pull out of China. So, you know, what's the right answer?
What moment are we
well,
in?
Like, some things are getting very scary. You know, when the permanent leader says that he's going to grind people into gunpowder who support the Hong Kong protesters, and there, you know, there are very credible reports that they're harvesting organs from live Muslims against their will for transplants and
the
things
Uyghur
like
population.
That. Yeah, the Uyghur population, absolutely.
An editorial note here. The Chinese government told CNN in June the allegations regarding, quote, live organ harvesting are completely fabricated, unquote, and said, quote, the government attaches high importance to the issue of organ donation and transplantation,
unquote.
You start to worry. I mean, like, a lot. And so I think as a business, you know, you get into the situation, we look back on the businesses that supported Nazi Germany and, like, that's their legacy.
Is
like, it's hard to get away from that.
It sounds to me like you're thinking deeply about this now. And yeah, it matters where your money goes. Is it going to change the businesses, how they operate, that you guys are invested in?
Yeah,
and where's the line between what's worth a profit or not?
Well, look, I think it's a very, like, when you talk about geopolitics, it's very, very, very difficult to assess every country and everything and figure out, like, where you come out and all these sorts of things. But for sure, it's something that we have to understand and think about, and it does matter. And the people of China we work with all the time and love and are brilliant scientists and engineers and in many of our companies, and our companies work with them and all these kinds of things. So, you know, when the government kind of goes a different direction, and like I'm not a geopolitical, I'm not a Chinese expert to the extent that I can assess that at this point, but it's certainly something I think big CEOs have to pay attention to and figure out where they stand, because
they're going to get asked.
Like that was, I don't think a lot of people expected the reaction that we got on the NBA thing. That was like an eye opener.
For sure.
Like, okay, this is very real and very different than what we're doing here in the United States.
On Facebook, obviously you guys were early investors. Mark is on the board. We just saw Mark Zuckerberg on the Hill testifying about Libra. You guys signed on as founding members of the Libra organization.
Yep.
What's your view on that? I mean, you've seen all of the regulatory pushback. You saw Mark Zuckerberg respond and say, look, if we don't do it, China's going to do it. How does this thing play out?
Well, I can't predict how it plays out. But, like, what Facebook is trying to do is much more kind of, I would say, simple and straightforward than is being portrayed. So a challenge with money generally is it doesn't scale internationally. Currencies are by country for a lot of reasons. There's a new technology known as cryptocurrency, which has got like this neat property that it's just software. It's not necessarily, doesn't have to be owned by a company. And the kind of properties of the monetary instrument are encoded into the software in this kind of very interesting trust layer where you trust the mathematical and game theoretic properties of the system. So what they're saying is, look, let's introduce something that a cryptocurrency that can be used for payments that we won't own, that'll be owned by an association, that we can use in, you know, products like WhatsApp to do global payments.
It does give Facebook more power if it goes through.
Well, I think that it enables them to build a product that would be hard to otherwise build at that level of quality and convenience for its customers. So, yeah. But in anything, right, yeah, anything that succeeds in business makes you a more powerful business for sure. The regulatory questions have been so, like, weird. one of the questions was, well, how many LGBT people do you have working on Libra? Now, first of all, Mark Zuckerberg's got a lot of projects at Facebook, and he hires and like people quit like at a very high rate every day. So how you would know how many of any people you'd have is one thing, but like it's illegal to ask somebody if they're LGBT. You can't know that. So like how is like a lawmaker asking him that as part of the thing? So it's just gotten so like circus that it's hard to say. I'm not sure exactly what's worrying the regulators, because like the questions they're asking are so bananas to me. But you know, like generally I think it would be good for the US and good for the industry if Libra succeeds and there's a way to do global payments for any company. And you know, kind of pegged, it's not its own currency in that it's pegged to like the government currencies.
I'm fascinated by it. It's really important. So I'm fascinated by how it's going to play out. And I don't know watching that.
I have no idea.
Let's stick on Facebook for a moment. You know, I don't have to tell you that Mark Benioff called Facebook, quote, the new cigarettes.
Yes, he did.
He also said to me,
easy for him to say.
He said to me, it's addictive. It's not good for you. They're after your kids. They're running political ads that aren't true, and they should probably be broken up. What do you say in response?
Well, like my partner's on the board of Facebook, my business partner, Mark Andreessen, so I can't make a lot of comments, but I would say,
but you're
I don't agree, I don't agree with Benioff. I mean, I don't think that's right. I think that these new technologies get used in ways that you don't anticipate. And I would say that most specifically in the case of Facebook is we had rules for what you can do in a public square when the public square was 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. And now it's 2 billion people and it's international. And we never came out with new rules either from, and I don't know that Facebook should be setting those rules or Twitter or anybody else. But it's tricky because...
Well, I don't think you'd agree with companies setting their own rules ever, right? Really?
Well, I think that normally you can kind of set at least the rules of how your company behaves.
You can set your own rules, but in terms of regulation...
It's a new thing to have 2 billion people interacting with each other globally on anybody's product. That's a new thing.
I think one of the concerns I know that a lot of people have is information and the political ads, being able to run false political ads on Facebook is just the latest example of a bigger issue. And Mark Zuckerberg, as you know, has defended it and said, look, we should not be, A, we don't have rules of the road. We should not be censoring, in his words, free speech.
I think it's a little more specific than that, because what he's saying is we shouldn't, very specifically, in a political ad, say what's true or not. We shouldn't be the arbiters of which politician is telling the truth.
So you think he's making the right call? Because, for example, CNN is not airing ads that we know have false things in them.
Yes, but in his case, Elizabeth Warren has said, Mark Zuckerberg's out to get me. And now she wants him to decide whether her ad is true, she says, I can pay Medicare for all is affordable. There's a lot of people say she's just lying on that. Maybe she is, maybe she's not, right? Who knows? Should Mark Zuckerberg make that, should Facebook make that decision, or should that decision be made by the voters? And I think he's got I don't really think a company deciding what's true or not. And CNN has a political viewpoint that Facebook doesn't, as does Fox News, as does MSNBC.
Well, CNN doesn't have a political viewpoint. I'm serious about saying this. You can have your view, but that's our job, is to be down the middle and to press the Democrats and the Republicans. It's what I do every morning.
Yeah, but I think that, I think a news organization that has a specific audience that makes money on it is also, I think that's a legitimate question. And I don't know, I think his answer is probably the correct one. It's a very difficult kind of, it's just a very difficult one, because either way he'd go, if he was making that decision and he eliminated any ad that either party ran, there'd be a massive protest on that.
Do you think, and we'll move on after this, I'm just interested in your take, Elizabeth Warren, you brought her up, she mm-hmm. says Facebook has too much political power. Mm-hmm. Is she right?
Well, I think, here's what I would say. It is, I don't know if it's Facebook or the Facebook community. I think the Facebook community is very powerful, but it is a giant community. But the history of media or media technology has been that it has had a lot of political power. For example, the radio got Hitler elected. No question, right? Without the radio, his rise to power doesn't happen. The television got Kennedy elected. Facebook got Obama elected.
Did Facebook get
everybody
President
was
Trump
happy.
Elected?
I think President Trump won on Facebook, no question. And that's what actually triggered the outrage. But it's something that's been going on for years. And then the question is, okay, now that we know that, now that things have changed, and you have this new media that drives elections, just like television did, just like radio did, what's the right governance for it? How should it work? And so forth. And I think you don't know that until it actually happens.
Does Mark Zuckerberg, with 58% of Facebook, given that he has a little over 75% of Class B shares, does he have too much power there? Is he right? Is he the best leader in this moment to have the chairman and CEO role?
I think he's an excellent leader. He's a very earnest person. I'm sure you've at least interacted with him and so forth. And his intentions are the right ones. Now, I think it's a very complicated, it's complicated. I would just say, you know, Facebook's, it's a very complicated system.
Okay. Can we talk on diversity? Because I know this is an issue that's, that's very important to you, and it's something that we don't have enough of in the Valley for sure. Let's talk about your experience with it, because you guys have, in the last year, just added 4 women, I believe, general partners out of 17 now, right?
Yeah, I'm not even sure of the number, but something like that.
But talk about that, because, you know, some of the criticism of you guys has been you were slow to the game in terms of adding more women. What do you think?
Well, it's not true, because, like, if you look at any other top-tier venture capital firm, they were all around, like, 50 years before they added their first woman, and, like, we're less than 10 years old, so, or we're just 10 years old, so I think that that's just not an accurate statement. Look, if you look at the firm just generally, we're 52% women. We're, you know, I think it's 22% African-American and Hispanic. We're, like, I think 17% Asian and so forth. So it's, like, just a pretty diverse firm. But, like, the, you know, specifically the reason women general partners took a little longer was basically the original rules that we set up, which was the original brand promise of the firm. And I changed that for other reasons, but, you know, and, like, and we ended up with a more diverse general partner base. But I think, like, the way you do inclusion is important, because what's important isn't actually the numbers. Like, if we had 70% women or 80% Chinese people, I would be fine with that. What I care about is, what does it mean to work there? And what are, like, what are the relative employee satisfaction rates, promotion rates, attrition rates across gender and race? Because that says, can you see the talent of everybody coming in? Like, do you really understand their capabilities and what they can do? Or are they dismissed because, like, you're talent blind? And if you can see the talent, then eventually, like, at least my view is the talent is out there.
Okay.
You don't have to, or, like, you're going to track the right kind of people if you can see the talent. And you'll be able to see them coming in and you'll hire them.
Because you said, and I thought it was interesting, just building on your point, what you said, I think it was to the LA Times in 2015, you said this: I know that my firm would get 1,000 times more credit if we had at least one woman general partner rather than 53% of the firm being women, but that's the least impactful thing I can do. That struck me, because I think most CEOs would be scared to make a statement like that.
Well, they want the gold star that says, you know, I love this group, I love that group, right? Like, they, that's what they're going for. But I think the more important thing is, like, can you see the talent and you value it? Because, like, that's the actual cultural sustainable thing. You look at these companies that go for the gold star, and the people who work that they attract leave very quickly and don't like working there and don't get promoted, and their numbers never change for that reason.
And on this point, you said to the Wall Street Journal at their tech conference, I think just last week or so, that some companies still see diverse talent, African-Americans, women, as, quote, second-class citizens inside their own companies.
Right, because they go in the side door. It's like, okay, we need more women. We need more Hispanics. We need more African-Americans. So we're going to have a special diversity group, and you're not going to go through the regular interview kind of criteria. You're going to go through the side interview criteria. Okay, well, that's fine for getting people in, but once they get there, then they have to live with that decision that you made, because everybody else in the company can't unsee what they just saw. And so you've created an environment where, like, it's just a bad place to work if you're coming from a diverse group. The real thing, like, if you're doing it the real way, then you will, like, understand what people bring to the table that aren't like you. So, like, here's the dynamic in hiring is, and you can look at any organization, there's a man running that group. There's a lot of men working there. There is a Chinese person. There's a lot of Chinese people. There's a woman. There's a lot of women working there. And that's because people get left to their own devices, just hire themselves. It's like, I know what I'm good at. I can test for it in an interview, and I value it highly. Great. Okay. You have to break through that. If you actually care, or if you actually have a real inclusion strategy, you have to get beyond those criteria. You have to get to things that you don't have. And I'll give you an example of this. So we had a group, I mean, our group, when we started the firm, everything was like that.
Well, I was going to also ask you about the Cultural Leadership Fund, what you guys are actually doing on this front.
Yes, yeah. So, well, that's part of it. But, look, it started with our own firm. And, you know, we had, like, you know, Frank Chen was running research, we had all Asians working for him. You know, Margaret was running marketing, we had all women working for him. It was all that kind of thing. And so I asked Margaret one day, I was like, well, what's in your criteria where no man can get the job? And she said, helpfulness. And I, you know, it took me back. I was blown away because I was like, well, look, I don't know a lot of helpful men. But more importantly,
I know a lot of helpful.
Well, you know more than I do. But here's the biggest thing on it. I didn't have that as a criteria. We're a venture capital firm. We're a services organization. How can anticipating somebody's needs and acting on them before they ask not be powerful for a firm to distinguish it in the marketplace? Nobody had that in their criteria. We were blind to that skill. By widening the bar, not lowering the bar, by widening the bar, like, we can now, somebody comes in who's helpful, we can value that. We can value it on the way in and make us more likely to hire them, and we can value them once they get there and learn from them and make that a real thing, as opposed to trying to value somebody for, like, what color they are, which is just, like, takes you right back to, like, the stupid kind of racist ideas that got us here in the first place. And so you really have to, in order to make inclusion work, you have to be able to see the talent. You have to be able to recognize talent that you don't have. And that's
a process. And quotas are not the answer.
No. It's a process for understanding talent that you don't have, because it's not just on the way in. It's once they get there. Like, that's a more important thing, because, you know, bringing in people and making them miserable in your company, like, that, you're not helping anybody with that.
But I ask this of almost every executive I sit down with. You're a father. You have three kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you want your kids to say about you one day?
Well, that's a, you know, they're adults now. My kids are adults.
They're still your kids.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, when they look back at you and all you've accomplished and written and done and how you've parented, what is your hope in the end of the day?
You know, like, I would just say, you know, I hope they say that I tried to contribute more than I took out, but, you know, they're their own people now at this point, so they're probably, you know, I'm very proud of my kids, so I would just say that, like, that's probably the thing that I hope they take away, is that, you know, they came out all right, and so maybe I didn't mess it up.
There you go. I think that's the best any of us parents can hope
yes.
for. Ben Horowitz, appreciate the dialogue and congratulations on the book.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you
so
very
much.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of Boss Files. I would love to hear your thoughts on this week's episode and people you want to hear from. So leave a review and follow me on social media at Poppy Harlow CNN.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.